we are living in a chemical world, and I'm a chemical nondescript person. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl or boy. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical.
Hi, I'm Kenna Crampton. Welcome to Chemical World.
And I'm Maggie Saldine, here with a big book of facts and a big bag of books to talk to you today about the science of addiction.
Yes, this episode is The Science of Addiction.
How drugs and our bodies affect each other. So, Kenna, to start off, I actually, while looking through my various resources today, I wanted to address something you had said or a question you had asked in the last episode that I was listening to something more about this today. So we had talked before about the detriments of substance abuse and like the community costs. So, of course, we know like the individual costs are overdose and disease and addiction and all the strife that comes along with that. But we had talked about some of the community consequences, such as lost productivity. And you had asked like what that means exactly. Mm-hmm. So I was watching this video today with Dr. Rob Valek, who's a leader in opioid treatment here in Colorado, and he had some interesting data that I thought could better answer that question. So I just wanted to do that real quick. So the data that he presented on, so this is from 2006. So this is really old if you, you know, think about the way that things change in this and many other scientific fields. So in 2006, the projected or estimated costs of drug abuse in the United States were $53.2 billion. And medical costs, substance abuse treatment costs, and criminal justice system costs only made up about $11 billion of that, with the rest all being lost productivity. So that lost productivity is really where we're seeing the most economic costs, is also why I thought it was valuable to bring back up. And the way that Rob Valek described that are, you know, the lost time and money when you're unable to go to school, you're unable to go to work, you're unable to care for your children or your parents or whomever. And so that's what we're really talking about with lost productivity, is people who have substance abuse issues are unable to care for themselves and others and have to rely on system dollars to do that.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks for mentioning that, because I do think it's easy for people to think of things in terms of money. And, you know, to me, loss of productivity in my mind more means, you know, what you're doing physically. But I think it is important to note that the less productive you are, the more tax money is going into keeping you alive. And more tax money goes into people who are incarcerated as well. So if you're not being productive and then you're also in prison, it's just a lot of time and resources and money that go into that. And I feel like I'm not making any sense.
It makes sense to me. Yeah, we just need to really be able to see sometimes those economic costs, because a lot of people might think, oh, I don't know how drug addiction or overdose affects my life, but it does in an economic sense. And something I thought of in the shower recently is I have never seen a cow born, but I know that calving happens all spring long here in the Roaring Fork Valley. So the things we do definitely affect each other, whether we're aware of them or not.
Yeah, and the things that people in our community are doing are affecting everyone in the community and outside of the community. You know, we're all in this together, as we keep saying in COVID, and it just, of course, it feels more true now, but no matter what, we're all on this world together, and we are all in this together, and what we do affects everyone.
Absolutely. And I love the Mountain Fair shirts this year had the year on it with 2020 Stronger Together. You don't always see the year on those shirts. So that was cool. I enjoy that. We'll always remember that. Yeah, we're stronger together. So getting into the topic for today, I wanted to talk about the science of addiction, because it's pretty different than what we probably all think about because, you know, like it or not, we were all raised by the culture that produced things like Reefer Madness and the War on Drugs. So we tend to have kind of a skewed version of what we think addiction is, and media doesn't help that. And even, you know, for me, someone who's been around addicts of all kinds my entire life, you know, the ideas I have of addiction are probably not accurate either. So the of the many books I brought, one of them is called The Science of Addiction by Carlton K. Erickson, and that one's a pretty good read. And in it, he talks about what he refers to as big A addiction and little A addiction. And so with little A addiction, it's like I'm addicted to shopping. I just can't stop. And I don't want to, you know, disparage the severity of people who have big A shopping addictions. But basically, we tend to throw the word addiction around pretty loosely in our culture.
Right. I'm addicted to chocolate. I'm addicted to this show that just came out. I'm addicted to, yeah.
Laser hair removal. Yeah, it's just we do toss it around a lot. And in that respect, you know, Erickson describes a little bit more in detail what, you know, the big differences there are in terms of biology. But I think it's important for me, at least, to think about some of the kind of historical definitions. And so for me, the definition of substance abuse that made the most sense is using despite negative consequences. You know that if you drink tonight, you're not going to be able to go to work tomorrow and you still drink. That to me is kind of that line of big A and little A addiction. Is it causing problems in your life?
Yeah. And because you can't always, everybody's rock bottom is different. And so, yeah, it's like what my rock bottom looks like and what your rock bottom looks like is different. But like you said, if there's still the negative consequences that are happening and you're overlooking those negative consequences so you can continue to get high or get drunk, that's when there's real problems. And it's not necessarily like, oh, well, they were waking up on this middle in the middle of the street naked. I don't have that big of a problem. You know, it's still, you know, it's all relative to who you are and what your life is. But negative consequences and doing it anyway, that's very cut and dry. I like that.
Yeah. And that's why, you know, my whole thing is promoting all kinds of recovery, not necessarily 100% abstinence, because if you are able, you know, if you are able to get out of that gutter and put some clothes on and get back to your life and get back to your job and uphold all of your family responsibilities and uphold all of your personal responsibilities to yourself to be the best you can be. Who cares if you still smoke weed? Who cares if you still have a drink every now and then? I certainly don't care about that. What I'm interested in is you having a better life, you know, and that means a better life for your family and for your community and your coworkers and everyone down the line.
Right on.
So another way of thinking about these definitions of addiction, if we go off the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, commonly referred to as the DSM, we're in the fifth edition of the DSM right now, and the fifth edition really changed a lot of how we diagnose mental illnesses, specifically in the sense that basically you'll have like a list of symptoms and you have to have at least two or more or whatever it'll tell you, you know, it, but it's usually like a long list of symptoms, and to be diagnosable you only have to present with a certain amount of them. And then there are these severity levels. So, you know, maybe you're bipolar 2 according to the DSM, but it's really not causing a lot of problems in your life and you're still able to maintain. And so you might have, you know, a mild severity of that disorder. And again, it's really looking at how manageable is your life with the symptoms you're currently living with. And so it really made it pretty easy to diagnose people. And the DSM gets a lot of criticism for making it too easy to diagnose kids with ADHD, for example, because it is pretty easy, and counselors and psychiatrists really need to have that personal responsibility to look at the entire context of an individual's situation before diagnosing. So the book alone can't give you a ton of information, but it does at least give us that insight into that you know, mild, moderate, and extreme severity levels of disorders. And so it gives you a little bit more wiggle room to kind of identify how to move forward with your own symptoms.
Cool. And it's nice to be able to self-diagnose. Of course, that's a little bit dangerous when you're going online and you're on WebMD. But if you can kind of get an idea of like, okay, this is how I'm feeling. Is this a problem? You know, I'm having 3 beers every night. Is that a problem? And you can kind of look at it and get an idea of where you should start.
Yeah, and from the practitioner's perspective, too, you have a little bit more flexibility. You know, you don't have to put somebody on extreme antipsychotic medication. You can work with them with therapy and acupuncture and more holistic measures. And I believe that that should always be, you know, the first try. And then those, you know, medical drugs should be the last line of defense when all else fails. But yeah, and with self-diagnosing, of course, I wouldn't recommend it, but I do believe that the patient is the expert on themselves. And you know if something's not right. Somewhere deep inside you, you know if you feel like something's off. And, you know, sometimes getting online and looking into it and reading a little bit more about these things can at least be a catalyst or, you know, a jumping off point to get real help. So according to The Science of Addiction with Carlton K. Erickson, we really want to look. So this is, I guess, my third kind of way of defining that difference between big A and little A addiction. We really want to look at the brain chemistry because that's kind of the biggest breakthrough. This book is great, and it talks about how, you know, 20, 50 years ago, there was these intense arguments happening in the medical community about whether or not addiction was a disease. And it wasn't until the 60s and 70s that medical associations started really acknowledging addiction and alcoholism as diseases. But now we know so much more through, you know, brain scans and the different imaging that we can do. We can now really kind of see the mechanisms of action that are occurring in addiction. And really what's going on is your reward system or your mesolimbic dopamine system, which is in charge of like telling you that chocolate tastes good and that you know, things that are exciting are good for you. And they basically communicate all your positive feelings to your body and brain. This is the area where we see issues with neuron activity in the addicted brain. And so we can literally see a difference between somebody who has a scientific diagnosable addiction to a substance versus the person who is addicted to that show and they can't stop watching it. Uh-huh. And so that gives us a lot more to work with. But it's interesting, too, how I can make it vaguer because somebody may have an issue with alcohol, but they may not have that biological dependence. That doesn't mean that they're not going to drink themselves to death. It just kind of adds another thing that we can look at to try to help them and provide them the best treatments.
I read this book when I was first getting sober that really talked about that with in relation to alcohol, because when it comes to things like AA and abstinence programs, there is very much of there's alcoholics and then there's everybody else, or addicts and then there's everybody else. And I really it really helped me because she made it clear, like, you know, alcohol and drugs, these are substances that anybody can become addicted to. Of course, there are people who are predisposed to possibly become addicted easier. Everybody can become addicted. And that's kind of the point of the book, This Naked Mind. It of course, the chemicals in your brain have a lot to do with it, but they're still substances at the end of the day. And if you're doing them excessively, you can become addicted to them.
Yeah, and that leads me perfectly kind of to the two theories of how that neuron dysregulation happens in the reward system of your brain. First of all, I just want to acknowledge that, you know, these conversations have been happening for decades, but now we just really have the science to back it. And so it's becoming harder and harder for people to ignore the fact that addiction is a disease, and it is a disease that occurs in our brains. First of all, that dysregulation of neuron activity. So what I mean there is that your neurons are not working properly in your reward system. For whatever reason, there's too many. There's too much dopamine being released. There's not enough dopamine being released. There's something wrong happening in your reward system of your brain. And there's two major theories of how this happens. So the one major theory is that it just already you're born with it. And it already exists, and then you take your first drink, and your brain is already like that, and you're genetically predisposed to develop an addiction to that substance. The other theory is that chronic exposure, so binge drinking for long periods of time, or using heroin regularly for weeks on end, things like that, that's when neuron dysregulation can begin to occur as well. And so what's interesting with genetic science is we all have genetic predispositions, but whether or not a specific gene is activated is kind of a matter of random chance and experience. And again, so there are definitely biologic reasons, but there are also definitely social reasons, and there are definitely also cultural reasons why people have issues with alcohol, whether or not they have the genetic brain dysregulation that's occurring. So you might have a genetic predisposition to addiction, but for whatever reason, that gene never gets switched and you never, you know, have that present itself as a problem in your life. So it's impossible to really tell who is potentially going to be an addict. I mean, we can have some ideas, but it is pretty easy now to be able to see that neuron dysregulation in that specific area of your brain. And I'll come back to that in a little bit, but I just want to diverge to say some interesting facts about, you know, people who develop addiction. Most people who take a prescribed medication that has a potential for abuse don't necessarily develop addiction. One thing that blows my mind, and this kind of ties back into the DSM ADHD piece, is tons of adolescent children take Adderall for ADHD, right? Do you know what's in your Adderall? Do you know what Adderall is made out of?
I don't. I took Adderall one time to help me get back on a drive from Portland to back to Colorado, and I will never try it again.
How long did you stay up for?
It wasn't as much that it wasn't keeping me awake. I was still really tired, but it was keeping me really anxious and like, and I just was white knuckling and just felt really anxious, and I just, oh my God, it was one of the worst feelings I've ever had.
Yeah, I just think that Adderall is a really interesting medication in general because it's basically meth. There's very little difference between Adderall and meth. And I mean, if you go and look at, you know, what's in cough medicines in the grocery store, there's a lot of stimulants hidden. And I mean, of course, at the turn of this century, there was a lot of laws to rein in things like pep pills and trucker speed and stuff like that. And of course, like making chloracetin and certain cold medicines not over the counter anymore. But regardless, I find Adderall to be very threatening just at face value. But in reality, a lot of kids take it and very few of them abuse it. You know, I just saw the people who abused it. That's just the world that I'm in. So that's what I see the most of. But the data is that that's very rare. And so if you think about that, these teens, these adolescent kids are exposed to meth, and it actually, you know, when taken with the right diagnosis and under the right conditions, it doesn't make you, you know, feel like you're going to lose your mind. It actually helps. And so it helps a lot of people, and those people don't develop substance issues later. And the same is true with prescription opioids. Most people who have prescription opioids don't abuse them. The issue is the potential for abuse there.
That's very interesting about the Adderall. Actually, one time when I was at a bar playing a show, a guy was offering people Adderall, and I was like, no, he just said he's all white, no green when it comes to drugs. And I was like, well, I'm the opposite. I'm all green, no white.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, and that's, you know, just my personal experience with Adderall. So I obviously have like a negative bias about it because I've only really seen it abused. But I know that it exists as a valuable medication, just like opium or morphine.
And these people that you know that have abused Adderall, did they have a prescription, or is it people that didn't have a prescription? They're just using Adderall as meth.
It's usually like somebody you know who has a prescription and they're your regular seller. So they're using it, but they have a prescription for it, and then they're just selling it to everyone else. Mm-hmm. Another, so speaking of the, you know, theories of how addiction forms, I just wanted to share because this is a fun personal story of mine. My mom used to tell me that two things happen the first time you use heroin. You either get really sick and you hate it and you never do it again, or you get really sick and then you just do it again the next day. And I mean, it's very simplistic, but I always really liked that because, yeah, most people do get sick the first time they use heroin. And my experience was I used it. I thought it was boring. I was way more into uppers. And so I just never really did it again. And her experience was, you know, the exact opposite. And so I just, for me, with heroin specifically, I liked her theory of how we develop heroin addiction.
Yeah, and that goes back to just what you were saying with, you know, you have these negative consequences. You know you're going to be hungover tomorrow morning if you continue drinking heavily, but you're just having so much fun and you do it anyway. It's kind of that same thing. Like a lot of people, they're like, they can kind of get that under control. They say, oh, I'm having fun, but I'm not going to continue getting wasted because I don't want to be too hungover tomorrow. Whereas, like, for me, like, that just wasn't a consideration. Like, oh, I'm going to be hungover tomorrow. It's like, well, I'm going to be hungover tomorrow anyway. So who cares? You know, it's like the same thing with heroin. It's like, I'm going to be sick anyway. I might as well be high.
Yeah, and it just, for me, really brings it back to that big A brain addiction that we're talking about, because it really messes with the parts of your brain that are specifically in charge of impulse control and your decision-making abilities. And so this leads really well into, I wanted to discuss a little bit about the specific mechanisms of opioid addiction, because it is a little different. And another thing you had said on a past episode, I think you were talking about crack being more addictive than cocaine, and I kind of corrected you in reference to this conversation. Opioids, heroin, fentanyl, OxyContin, they actually are a little bit, if not a lot bit, more addictive than other substances. But real quick, I will say on the crack piece, one of my other favorite books in my bag is High Price by Dr. Carl Hart. And he specifically did studies with crack users at Columbia University in New York. And his studies basically showed, we have this assumption that, you know, drug addicts, they're fiends, they will do anything for the drug and they only want the drug and nothing else. And he conducted this series of studies that basically showed that, like, even the most addicted crack cocaine user can make some, you know, rational judgments in terms of, he's in a test setting. Does he want another hit of crack right now when he just had one 20 minutes ago? Or does he want $5 because he knows that he can get more crack later? And so they do have the ability to make rational decisions. They're not just completely like cartoon character lunatics out for one and only thing in life.
Yeah, the one and only thing in life. They have, their brains can function well enough to make sure that they can get as much of the thing that they're going for.
Well, and
they
to
can make those decisions. Yeah.
Yeah, and also to acknowledge, you know, that we have, that there are always other needs. There's always food and shelter and clothing and water, and even, you know, for the most addicted person, these are still needs that they have to meet. And so you could view it as like they have to meet those needs to get high, but either way, they're capable of, you know, rationalizing to some extent. So with opioids, it gets a little more interesting, and it's just particularly dangerous because up until quite recently, you know, they were really easy to get. They're still relatively easy to get, but they're definitely getting harder, which is great. And our brains do react differently to them. So there are natural receptors in our brains for opioids because our body's endorphins are very similar. They create the sensations of pleasure and they send those sensations to the other parts of our body. So we have these natural receptors that create these good feelings, and opioids just come right in and fit with those very nicely. And they produce euphoria, so even greater than like our natural endorphins would, because they're boosting dopamine's effects by doing some other scientific brain stuff that I won't get too in depth into, because I just feel like that's not the extreme focus of the show. But, you know, in short, the opioids not only bind to our opioid receptors, but they also boost dopamine. And so they make us feel even better than normal. But over long periods of time, or not even that long, and as I will go into in just a moment, our body becomes used to that. And so our dopamine receptors, our opioid receptors start to decrease because we're used to having enough of that chemical in our brain. So our brain thinks, well, we don't need this many, these many receptors. The brain is very malleable, and the term plasticity is used a lot in neuroscience because even as an adult, your brain can really shift and adapt. You know, they say your brain is a muscle. If you don't use it, you lose it. And that's true. You can train your brain to form new neuronal pathways, and you can train your brain to decrease or increase certain kinds of receptors depending on what you put in your body. So when you have that decrease of opioid receptors, that's when you're, you know, getting dependence. And that's when, at that point, it's not so much about achieving that euphoric feeling, but avoiding the deep, deep, unbearable sickness that will happen once you do not have those receptors filled with that drug anymore. And because the receptors are all through our brains and our spinal columns, that's where, you know, we get these full body aches from heroin withdrawal and these headaches. And it's also in our stomach, so nausea, and just that's where the pain is coming from, is basically like your body no longer has these receptors that it's dependent on. It kind of reminds me of the way we used to talk about ecstasy, where it's taking like ice cream scoops out of your brain. But we, you know, with a lot of these drugs, we talk about like these releases of endorphins, and then we, like, our body can't produce the same amount of endorphins again, and we go into depression. That's a common way we talk about MDMA and ecstasy. And it's similar, you know, our body doesn't produce the same amount of opioids that a 10cc shot of heroin does. So we get dependent pretty quick.
Well, since I've quit drinking, the idea of doing Molly anymore, like, I used to really like doing it. Even though I wasn't drinking, I would still, like, once a year take some Molly. And now it doesn't even sound like fun because the hangover is so bad. And I wonder if, like, I have retrained my brain to be like, no, you don't want to be hungover anymore. Like, because before it was like, whatever. Like I said, you're going to be hungover anyway. Like, I don't really care. That's not really going to keep me from getting wasted tonight. And maybe because I just don't have that hungover feeling anymore, like, the idea of taking Molly,
it's just like that much worse.
Yeah, it's going to be fun, but it's really only one night of fun for an entire, like, 2 weeks of recovery from depression.
See, and I don't ever remember really feeling that after taking ecstasy or MDMA, but as I've discussed on the show, I've often taken MDMA without knowing.
Taken MDMA thinking you were taking
MDMA. So and that's, you know, another one of my platforms is drug users use drugs. Like, they don't care what they are. They just want to get high. And so, unfortunately, for the many of my experiences, I was probably not, like, prepared because I didn't know what I was taking. And so I wasn't, like, looking out for that stuff afterwards. So it's hard to say. But I remember the first time that the first time I took ecstasy, and I knowingly took ecstasy, and I think I took ecstasy. And I remember preparing myself for that a little bit. And I don't know, I didn't really notice it. But I also am just, like, a really depressed person in life in general, so who's to say? But I know that that's like a big fear with yeah, that, and it makes sense to me based on the neuroscience of it.
Well, and again, I don't think that it used to be as bad when I was taking ecstasy or Molly and drinking, because I was already in a depression of a constant kind of fighting that cycle. And now that I don't usually feel that way, I generally, I'm more in tune with my depression and anxiety because I'm generally sober. Now, when I do take ecstasy, it's like I really notice how crappy I feel afterward. And I'm not drinking to keep the depression away or anything. Like, I just got to sit in it and deal with it until it's passed. Which it's like, yeah, again, I'm already fighting that as it is. So why would I want to make it worse just for one night of fun?
Totally. And yeah, now in you're in sobriety and with so much time, you can really like see that for what it is. But I think you're right on the money. Like I never was like a regular, you know, Molly or ecstasy user. But so I can think of, you know, the handful of times that I think I took ecstasy or something. And I can just think of so many other situational things that would have caused me depression. And like, yeah, I was still drinking every day. So that makes sense that like I wouldn't have maybe noticed it, even though I was like, to a certain extent, aware of it. Because I remember when that first time I was like, I was 15, because I remember it was on my trip to California for my mom's funeral. So yeah, plenty of reasons to be upset otherwise, but you know, I'm cool and tough and all that stuff. Yeah. But that was like that era that they were having all of those weird anti-ecstasy commercials and all of that weird ecstasy propaganda. You know, the story of the girl who I think drowned because she drank so much water on ecstasy at a rave. And so it was like really at that time, it was actually pretty prevalent in mainstream media. Although I heard that those campaigns were a big waste of money. Like I said, opioid dependence actually can develop pretty fast. This is more data from good old Rob Vallick up at the state level. And so it usually begins, so say you're taking like a Percocet prescription at home, dependence will begin within about 2 weeks. And you'll notice the symptoms of withdrawal within about 3 weeks. So this is part of...
And sorry, that's just with a prescription like that your doctor says take two a day, you're going to become dependent on it, just those two a day?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're taking an opioid every day. And
sorry,
so that's...
I've never actually been prescribed opiates, so this is, like, so crazy a little bit. So
yeah, no, and that brings up a really good point, because I have been prescribed many opiates. I've been prescribed opiates on accident. Like, I just showed up at the pharmacy and was like, I don't want Vicodin. I want mouthwash. And thank God it was me and not somebody else who would have easily, you know, gotten that prescription that day. They were like trying to fill it and everything. But even before that, like I've just had a lot of surgeries and pain issues throughout my life. And when I was much younger, I would literally, I mean, so you might hear about doctor shopping is where people go around trying to find doctors that will give them pain medication, and they'll have multiple doctors that they're getting pain medication. I was doing something similar, but just in the ER. I was just going to the ER regularly, and I knew that. So there's the pain scale that they ask you from 1 to 10, and depending on the number you give, it depends that like determines which kind of opiate they give you. And so I knew the whole system, and I would go in there and knew what I want. And I was living a very rough and tumble lifestyle, so I would usually have some at least like quasi valid reason for being there, like, oh, I think I broke my nose or something like that. But in reality, I was just there to get the pills, and it worked. There's been a lot of movement recently about this, and I've, again, experienced personally, because I have a lot of dental work, which I think I've mentioned, because it's another common problem we see in the recovery community. And I am no longer being even offered opiates. A year ago, I had to decline them, and now they're not even offering them to me anymore. So that's great, because the science is that ibuprofen and Tylenol, when taken in combination and rotated every 2 hours, is better. And I can tell you from my experience with extreme dental surgery, it is better. It works better. And I don't feel like screwed up and in pain. I feel like my pain is a little bit mitigated. And Rob Vallick has done a lot of presentations on this. I would really encourage anyone interested to look him up, because he's got a lot of really good data that he's happy to share. But so we, you know, this has been happening for a while now, but there have been some big changes in how doctors prescribe opiates for exactly these reasons that I'm talking about. And so, yeah, you get a prescription. So again, my experience with these prescriptions is they're usually 2 weeks to a month. And my experience with surgeries and the like is that they're usually helpful for about 2 days. And then usually your pain level is manageable after that point. Like the first day or two after surgery is usually when things are the hardest, when your general anesthetics or whatever are wearing off. But after that, it's really so much easier to manage with ibuprofen and Tylenol. And honestly, even those first 2 days are pretty manageable. So this information is out there because we're really trying to get people to do the minimum amount possible that they can prescribe, because it is so easy for anyone to become addicted to these opioids. And opioids specifically interact even more with that frontal lobe part of your brain that's responsible for decision making and impulse control again. And so heroin itself won't cause damage to your organs of your body like alcohol or nicotine would, or even cocaine. It will make you constipated and it will make it hard to have any sort of libido, but really it doesn't hurt your body. But what it does in your brain makes it so much harder to overcome the addiction that has just happened biologically in your body because of these receptors, because now your impulse control and your decision making are a little off because of your opioid use, and it can just get worse and worse over time. So that's what makes it really particularly easy to get addicted to opioids, and really particularly hard to get sober from opioids.
Yeah, that's really interesting about, you know, and that was something that she mentioned in my book, This Naked Mind by Annie Grace, that, yeah, what heroin does to the body compared to what alcohol does to the body is almost non-comparable. Mm-hmm. But what we're talking about is what's going on in the brain. And what makes heroin, like you said, more addictive, one, but then also messes up so many other things in your life because of what it's doing to your receptors up in your brain. But it's not necessarily deteriorating your organs or anything like smoking and alcohol does.
Right. It's actually a safer drug in a lot of respects. And I think that that's fair to say. But it's hard because it's harder to I don't want to say it is harder to quit because of what's happening in your brain, although other substances like alcohol can do similar things. And then, yeah, you're potentially making worse decisions out in life in general and putting yourself mm-hmm. in riskier situations and, you know, shirking your responsibilities.
Not to mention that we have to say the brain is a part of the body, and what's bad for the brain is bad for the body, even if it's not deteriorating your organs. If it's bad for your brain, it's bad for your body. But that's probably why they've been making painkillers out of opiates, is because it isn't bad on your body, but it helps with the pain. Is that something? Is that fair assessment to make?
I feel like they've just been using opiates longer than they've been using anything else. But mm-hmm. I do think, you know, it's almost a catch-22 in the medical world. Like, I always have felt like if you change, you know, sugar for stevia, I bet stevia will cause cancer in 20 years too, or something. You know, it's so hard to find healthy alternatives. But that's a really interesting one because, I mean, acetaminophen, a lot of our, you know, over-the-counter pain medications can cause serious liver damage and can be really dangerous to combine with alcohol. So, you know, it just kind of depends on your body what is the safest option for you. And again, it's different for everybody. So the only other things that I wanted to say about that data from Rob Valick is just that we, you know, really, again, want to reduce the amount of pills that are being prescribed, because 91% of people only need 15 pills or less to manage their pain. Because like I said, really, it's just those first couple days that are the hardest. You don't need to be taking opiates 2 weeks later after a minor surgery. There's no real purpose to that. But the likelihood of having continued use at 1 and 3 years after your initial prescription goes up immediately after the first day amount. Does that make sense? Like, so you have a prescription for 1 day of opiates. The second you get that 2-day prescription, your likelihood of still using it in a year or 3 years starts to skyrocket.
Wow, that's Kind of scary. So and that increases with every day, you said?
Yeah, it does. There's a Rob again has a great graphic, and it just that it really like skyrockets in the first couple of days, and then it does continue to increase, although it looks pretty much like a graph, you know, with the squiggly lines and such. But yeah, so the more opiates you're prescribed at the initial prescription, the more likely you are to still be using it later. Because if you, and that's what is really so scary, is if you're just following your doctor's orders and taking two opiates like Percocet or Vicodin a day for 2 weeks, you are developing dependence. And you, at the end of that 2 weeks, you're just high. I mean, you're not really treating anything.
Mm-hmm. And again, where can people see this graph?
So I would just Google Rob Valick, or even put it into YouTube. He just has these presentations that he's done on YouTube. He's part of the Colorado Consortium for Prescription Drug Abuse Prevention. So you could go to their website as well. But the YouTube videos, I think, are just the best place to get the information.
Cool.
And then the other final piece on that is that 73% of people in addiction facilities started with someone else's pain prescription. So additionally to not taking your own pain prescription for 2 weeks unless absolutely necessary, we're really working on getting like pill take-back programs happening and encouraging people to dispose of their old medications properly, because that's the most common way that people get started on their opiate addiction is through a friend or family member's old prescription.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So my mom was a really vicious alcoholic the entire time while I was growing up. And then she quit drinking when I was about 11, which was like a miracle. And then within a year, she had developed a heroin habit. And so a lot of things happened in the interim, you know, to have that occur. But discussing it with a friend recently, because she hadn't really realized that my mom had quit drinking. And the reason I brought it up was because I was like, can you imagine what it would have been like if there had been booze in my house as a teenager? But there never was, because she had quit drinking before my interest, like a year before my interest in alcohol began. But it's interesting because she did struggle with alcohol for so long, and yet she was so easily able to replace it entirely with heroin. And so I think that there, and you know, they say that benzodiazepines like Valium or Klonopin or Ativan, they affect your brain very, very similarly, pretty much identically to the way that alcohol affects your brain. And so the drugs are very similar. So in AA, they don't even want you drinking non-alcoholic beers. I wonder how they feel about my Bud Zeros, because they're 0%. But anyway, you know, they encourage 100% abstinence. But benzodiazepines is kind of one of the worst things you can take if you're in recovery from alcohol, because it does the exact same thing in your brain. Mm. But I also think, you know, heroin is so similar. They're all central nervous system depressants. And when I say heroin anytime, I could just as easily be talking about Percocet or fentanyl or morphine. They're all the same root substance, right? So it's just interesting to me. There's definitely some similarities there, and there are similar treatments available that can work for both alcohol addiction and opioid addiction. But it's just interesting to me how they play out so similarly in our brains. So that's about all I have today for the science of addiction. But if you have any questions or are interested in any more book recommendations, feel free to reach out to me, Maggie Saldine, peer recovery coach with MindSprings Health, at 970-531-5060 or msaldine@mindspringshealth.org. And thanks for joining us on this extra episode. I hope you all are having a fabulous August and a fabulous overdose awareness month.
Thank you, Maggie. Thank you for all of the information. And I always learn so much with our episodes. So thank you for teaching me and continuing to teach the community. We will have an extra episode on August 31st in honor of International Overdose Awareness Day. That episode will be How to Identify an Overdose. And our next public affairs show will be on September 14th at 4:30, and that will be available at kdnk.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, and you can message us there as well. If you have any personal questions, Maggie can also answer them there as well. I can too, but she has a little bit more info than I do. And thank you. Take care, everyone, and remember, you do not have to be sober
to keep your community clean.
Drugs may come and drugs may go, and that's all right, you see. Experience has made me rich, and now I can use safely. It might be beer, it might be dope, it may even be caffeine. But we all have a little something that keeps us on our feet. What's important is being safe and stopping the spread of disease. You do not have to be sober to keep your community clean. 'Cause we are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl or boy. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical gender nondescript. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl. You know we are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl.